Welcome to the Lob Podcast, brought to you by Manscaped. Get 20% off Manscaped products when you use code TFT20.
Welcome to the Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and tonight we are re-entering the centre circle with a wonderful book. Both authors are with us of this book, but we'll get to our special guests in a couple of minutes. But first of all, my usual co-conspirators are with me. So first of all, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, welcome.
Oh, how are you doing, Stuart?
Very well. Looking forward to, well, I look forward to all of them, but this one's really, I'll explain why this one has sort of caught my attention and affection as we go through the podcast, but this one definitely very much looking forward to.
Yeah, this is one of those great books where it's more than just football. It's got a massive social imprint on it. You know, there's a massive impact to be made by the players that we'll discuss and the topic, and it's just one of those that, you know, speaks massively. Me being a child of the 70s and the 80s as well, you know, such a polarizing era for the topic as well, and just so much, you know, there's just so many tangents and angles to this, and you know, it's just a brilliant one to discuss, and such a fantastic book as well.
I know we normally say we've set aside an hour, and then we throw in the caveat quite early on that it's probably going to go over, but I think this will probably go over.
Oh, I'm positive.
Excellent. And obviously, from sunny Spain, I'm assuming it's sunny, Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, is it sunny?
It's not actually, it's raining. It's been quite overcast and rainy today, which has been the first time for a few days, so... It's sad me going to water the lemon tree outside, so that's okay. So it's the first one we opened in a few days. But yeah, as Stevie said, I just want to say this is a cracking book as well. I mean, it's one of those things when I read it, I went through it in about a day and a half, because it's one of those where you just keep turning the page and turning the page and turning the page. And there's so many punchy stories in there. And they're so, I won't say important, but important's not the right word. They're socially relevant stories. They're quite important as well. So it's going to be a great book to talk about and to discuss with the guys who put this massive information together.
Did you read it sort of, I want to say chronologically, from sort of page one to the end, or did you dot about all over the place like I did?
Well, I cheated and went to my hometown.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to know, because that's where I went first.
I went to Warsaw first, but then I went back to A and went my way through again from there.
Yeah, I did that as well. I was like a pinball machine. I was all over the place.
Yeah, I was.
Because you'd read one page and there'd be reference to another club, and it's like, oh, I'll go
exactly.
That way. And tell you what it felt like is as a kid, and Stuart will probably remember these books, was that there were a set of books where you'd read a chapter, and then at the end of the chapter, it would give you a choice. You know, go through the door, to chapter 3. Do not go through the door. Go to chapter 7, and then you'd have a choice. And this kind of reminded me of those books, because it's just so brilliant in that you do not have to, you can read it from page to page from start to finish, but there is you can read it in any way you can, you can go from club to club and, you know, follow player to player even, you know, so it's a great book that you can read in a multitude of ways.
Yeah. Oh, that's okay. I feel a bit better now. I was just, when you said you'd read it sort of from Pitt, I was like, oh no, I must have read it not the wrong way around, but gone at it from a different angle. But that is the beauty of this book. Like you say, you can approach it from any way you want. So obviously onto more important than just us chatting on, obviously the special guests, the authors are far more important than we are. And tonight's subject, black footballers had to fight tooth and nail to prosper in the game. from the very start, subjected to the most horrendous treatment, not only from supporters and opponents, but even from their own teammates at times. And while modern times like to see themselves, we like to see ourselves more enlightened, problems still persist in various unsavoury corners of the game. Towards a demographic that has given so much to the rich depth and history of the game. And in celebration of their contribution, not only with the ball, but in making those indelible first breakthroughs into the professional football environment.
But at school, as a nine-year-old, I was called a chocolate drop. And that was my first introduction to the sort of racism. You know, we were invited here, part of the Commonwealth, but the welcome wasn't as warm as we'd expected.
What helped me, what gave me the inspiration to be something was Brian Clough, simple as that.
He didn't have all that much confidence. I don't think he's got total confidence at the moment, even now.
I remember playing at Carlisle, and he said, I thought I told you to warm up. I said, well, I have been warmed up, but they're throwing bananas, eggs and pears at me.
Really, really pleased that tonight we're going to talk to the authors of the wonderful book, Football's Black Pioneers. It's Mr. Bill Hearn and Mr. David Glebe. Guys, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Hi.
Excellent. This is going to not tricky, but I'll do my best to make sure I'll sort of let you know where we're directing business. But both of you, first of all, thank you ever so much for agreeing to come on and chat about what is a wonderful book.
Thank you. Very much our pleasure.
We've synchronised.
Yeah, I can see now why this would have been better as a video, but that's okay. We'll go on it. So, David, I'll come to you first then. The book... You know, the guys have chatted already about not necessarily even the importance of the book, but the readability of the book and the easy access of the book in terms of its understanding. But where, if you just want to give us an overview of how the book actually works, and then why this particular book, you know, what was the motivation behind writing it?
Okay, well, I mean, I think I'll start by just saying a little bit about ourselves, actually. I mean, we're both football fans. Bill supports Sunderland and I support Crystal Palace. And we were both working together on a different project, Black History Project, that had nothing to do with football at all. And about 4 years ago, I think the work on that project was coming to an end. And so I think we were both looking around for something else to do. And rather out of the blue, Bill contacted me and said, why don't we try and research the first black player at each of the Football League clubs? And my immediate reaction, Bill tells me he's still got the email, was to say, well, that's a great idea, but it's ever such a lot of hard work. I think 4 years down the line, I would say it's still a great idea. I still think it's a great idea. And yes, it was a hell of a lot of hard work. I think that the initial motivation was that, you know, we're both very interested in football and we're both interested in black history. And so this was a nice way of us combining those two interests. And I think one of the things we were concerned about was that there were players who had been the first black player at their clubs, who we were in danger of forgetting about, because, you know, some of these players, we're talking about 130 years of football history, and some of them, we were going to lose them. Their names were going to drop off the radar if we weren't careful. And I think we've got examples of that, where if we hadn't done this research now and we'd left it a few years, the names would have disappeared. So we wanted to do it for that reason. We wanted to identify those kind of unsung heroes, if you like. And I'm very glad that a couple of you have already said that this is about more than football. I think Bill might agree with me. We didn't set off to write a book about more than football. That's kind of an accidental byproduct, but it has turned out, in my view, to be quite an important book about more than football. It does capture what it's been like to be a black footballer in Britain for the last 130 years, and not all of it makes very pleasant reading, but, you know, that is the nature of the game, I'm afraid. So it is about more than football. I'm actually proud of that, and I think it's a book that can contribute to the debate that's going on at the moment about racism in the game and more broadly in society at large. So I think probably I'm going to pause there. And if Bill wants to jump in and pick up anything else, then that's fine.
No, I think you've summed it up really well, David. Like you, I was surprised at the stories that we discovered. I thought it would be a case of, you know, black player makes debut, end of story, but their lives have been different. How they got to this country has been different. What they've experienced, what they've gone on to do after the game. So it's, I think we've ended up with, we've actually got 93. We included Macclesfield because it was such a good story. We've got 93, what I think are really interesting short stories and very different short stories.
I mean, like I say, to me, it's absolutely fascinating. And it is, you know, as we said at the beginning, the way, you know, and Steve mentioned as well, you sort of almost ricochet from story to story, like those choose your own adventure books where you'd read something, and go, oh, I'm going to that club next, or there might be mention of another player. So you go to find that player's story as well. Just before I move on to the other two guys, just a quick question for Bill. Well, we'll go with you, Bill, for this one. Co-authorship, how did you find that?
Ooh, there's a question. I think...
Sorry.
Well, no, I think Div and I have very different styles, but, you know, it's nice to share the burden. It was a lot of hard work, and I don't know how one person would have done 92 clubs, so, you know, I think it worked quite well.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'll chip in. I mean, I think probably 95% of the time it was... We were very amicable. It got on very well. There were one or two areas where we had disagreements, and occasionally they got quite heated. And I think particularly during lockdown, it was quite difficult to resolve that. I mean, if we'd been able to meet up over a pint, I'm sure some of the tensions that emerged would have been much more easily resolved. But I don't want to overdo that. The fact of the matter is, I think we did an amazing job. We worked very amicably together for 4 years.
We're still speaking, just.
So that is quite the undertaking, 4 years. Okay, so Gary, you know, this is sort of a subject that we come back to quite often. Certainly, you know, we have during in the political football, and we've done it with some of the other books that have looked at the historical aspects of the game, and that's the importance of keeping stories alive. But here, you know, arguably, it's probably never been more important than what these guys have done, and certainly with regards to this social demographic about, you know, keeping the stories alive, bringing them to a new generation.
Yeah, I guess that's true. You know, I'm sort of, you know, I'm a bit older than you guys. So I was at school in the 60s, junior school and senior school in the 60s and 70s, and I went to a sort of fairly, you know, basic secondary modern stroke comprehensive school, multiracial school. But growing up and going to football and seeing black players come through wasn't really an issue for me. But and it sort of it was a late dawning on my mind that to my sort of innocent soul that the racism was there. But once you sort of, you know, get recognise it, it's very difficult to shake off the shame of it, even if you're not involved in it, because you sort of feel it's, you know, you're all sort of being sort of you're all part of the same crowd, and you know, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. You know, if that doesn't sound too sort of trite, but it's such an important issue, and you know, it's dead easy. And you mentioned earlier that perhaps it's getting better. I ain't sure if that's the case. It might be getting different, but much of it's getting better. I just want to, if I can, just sort of ask Bill and Dave, because one of the first questions that when I read this book is, how do you do this? I mean, do you literally ring up 93 clubs and say, who was your first black player? Because I don't know how else you'd actually do it, because it's not something, you know, when you're sort of looking at players, at a list of players who play for a set club, they're not racially defined. And why would they be? So I don't know how, you might have sort of where they came from, the sort of the birthplace. And if they were born in sort of West Indies or Africa, that might be fine. That might help. But lots of black players were sort of born in this country. So I don't know how you go about that. I mean, was it literally picking up the phone saying, hello, Watford, hello, Gillingham, Maidstone, whoever you are, saying, who was your first black player?
No, not quite. A lot of clubs didn't know their first black player, which was one of the reasons we wrote the book.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, a whole variety of sources. I mean, if I talk about Aston Villa's first black player, well, his name is Willie Clark, but he was referred routinely as Darkie Clark.
Yeah.
Now, that was a disrespectful term now. It was perfectly normal in 1901 when he was playing. But had the press not called him Darkie Clark, there's a possibility we would never latched on to the fact that he might possibly be a black footballer, and as we dug deeper, we found that he was. But we looked at genealogical sites. We must have spent a small fortune on birth certificates, death certificates, marriage certificates, and so on. The internet is both a good and a bad source. I mean, there's so much misinformation out there. We did actually find a lot of things that were thought to be common knowledge, but were actually just not facts. Sure. Families are very, very helpful. Club historians, very, very passionate people, club historians, they were helpful. Didn't find the football clubs themselves of much help, to be absolutely honest.
Yeah. It's interesting. So yeah, forgive me. I mean, there's almost like two major groups of the players. So there's some players, like you mentioned, about the Aston Villa guy, who was quite early in the previous century. But the guy who in my hometown club was Warsaw, Mark Rees. I watched Mark Rees play in the 70s and 80s. So that was fairly... But I mean, I don't know if Warsaw would have had a black player, because it's a fairly industrial area where I used to come from before that. And I just wondered how you'd find these things out.
I think... go on, Bill.
Well, I was just going to say, because Mark Rees is one of the most difficult... Warsaw was one of the most difficult ones. I mean, I certainly spent a lot of time in the newspaper archives in Warsaw. I wrote to the club. I tried to contact Mark Rees. It was basically one of the fans forums, I think, that said, yeah, Mark Rees was our first black player. So, you know, we're pretty confident that he is. We've had nobody disputed it. Well, but it wouldn't surprise us if over the years somebody comes along and says, by the way, and a lot of them did this, oddly enough, we had a Nigerian who played for us in the 1920s in bare feet. And when we really, really researched it, sometimes they did have a Nigerian who'd come across on trial, perhaps, but never made the first team. So, you know, we can't rule out that history might change over time, and a Walsall fan might come along and say, here's a photograph from, you know, 1912, and look at this man, doesn't he look black? And we need to look at that very closely. But as of now, we're pretty convinced Mark Rees is the first black player.
And I was going to chip in on the question of forums as well, because I think the fans forums were generally more helpful than the clubs themselves, I think, in our experience. As Bill has said, in many cases, the clubs didn't even bother to respond. We were disappointed, I think, with the responses from many of the clubs. Forums, obviously, they're a patchy lot, but I mean, generally speaking, I think most of the forums I dealt with, and I think probably the ones Bill dealt with, were very, very helpful, and they bent over backwards. I mean, there's a player I might talk about a bit later who was Rochdale's first black player, and I don't think we would have got him at all had it not been for the help of the Rochdale Fans Forum, who were a great bunch.
Yeah. I'm just saying that because when I sort of flicked through the page, I was expecting the first black player at Wars to be Kenny Moore,
He was a week or two after Mark Rees.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. It was just, and then I looked it up, and you were right. He was the following year. Kenny Moore joined in 79, Mark Rees in 78. Yeah. But Kenny Moore used to live not far away from me when I was a kid. So, so great work, guys. Great work.
Can I just ask, Gab, since the books, you know, the book sort of publication, have the clubs got back to you with regards to sort of increasing their awareness, you know, almost, you know, you sort of educating the clubs on what you found out?
No, we've really tried. We tried to engage groups, football clubs, the press and so on. But no, we haven't had a massive response, unfortunately. But we've done all this work. We've got all this information. We do want to share it, and we do want people to enjoy it and make use of it. So it's a wide open door. But it sometimes seems that clubs don't want this free gift, or perhaps they're too busy. I don't know.
I just find that surprising. Obviously, like we say, with the current climate and what's happening, you would think there would almost be an embracing of, you know, of the book, and an embracing of the work that you guys have done. Is what I would be thinking from a football club's perspective. You know, here's two guys who've done an awful lot of research, sort of almost on their behalf.
I mean, I'll not name the club, but to me, it's a free gift. And we wrote to a club last week, I think it was, and I gave a lot of detail on their first and second black players. And I said, it's Black History Month, you might want to put something on your website. And I've had no response. And that's quite normal, unfortunately. Might be the way we're asking.
That's incredible. I mean, as I said at the beginning, the reason it's particular interest, I I teach at a college, and one of the programs that I teach on is foundation degree in football coaching. But my interest lies very much with the cultural and social aspects of football. And one of the modules that I teach that I wrote is a cultural influences in football. And we've just covered sort of diverse groups within football, and my students had to give a presentation on a different diverse group. And obviously one of them was black and minority ethnic association with the game. And once I knew this was coming on, and, you know, I sort of directed them, you know, directed my students to the book, and, you know, they were, it was fascinating to watch them. I mean, the age range is between about 18 and sort of 24, 25. And they knew so little about sort of black footballers, you know, the history of black players within the game. It was almost frightening how little they knew, even from things like Stephen said, you know, we're sort of child of the late 70s and 80s, but how little they knew about black players and sort of what they've gone through. You know, they've grown up in an era of Thierry Henry, Raheem Sterling. You know, they've grown up in that era where, you know, it's almost become commonplace, and they don't associate the struggles, and it's been a real education for them.
Well, my wife was a teacher for many years, and I mean, she and I have talked a lot about how this book could be used as a resource to teach all sorts of themes, actually, in schools. I mean, I believe that something called migration stories is one of the things on the curriculum. I mean, the number of stories you could pick out from this book that support that theme of migration stories, there's dozens of them. I mean, I'm convinced that this book could be really well used in schools and colleges for exactly the sort of thing you're talking about. But my particular beef is that black history in general is just very, very poorly understood in this country, not just football history, but black history in general. And if only black history was better understood, then maybe some of the problems we have in society at large would diminish. I mean, I'm really passionate about that.
I agree. I mean, I know this isn't the forum for this, but you're right. The fact that we have to have a special month for it is something I still can't wrap my head around why it has to be a particular month. Stephen, I'm really sorry. I've not forgotten you with us. I have remembered.
Oh, no, it's all right. It's fascinating. Listen, I'm just sat here enjoying what I'm listening to. Yeah.
I was just about to say, following what was said there, and you kind of mentioned at the beginning, this, although the book is very much a look at the first black players of each club, it's actually almost secondary. I think the guy said that in their introduction as well. It's almost secondary to what the book is about. There are so many social and cultural strands and historical strands. You know, it almost spans practically 120 years, this book, in terms of development within the game, the social impact, the cultural impact within the game.
Oh, it's an incredible piece of work. You know, it's the journey of the player, you know, how they got there. You know, yes, there's a few stats and, you know, a debut was made here and a last game was made there, you know, transfers and stuff like that. But it's predominantly about the journey and how they, you know, find their way into, you know, the football club in question, you know, and where they went beyond that wherever possible. And, you know, it is a wonderful way to plot the path of the... there's an element of... I mean, I always have that fascination of history anyway. So, you know, there's that element of who do you think you were, who do you think you are? You know, the all of these type of genealogy-type programs. And this is where the fascination is for me. And it is the path that these players took and the determination to prevail and succeed wherever possible. You know, you can look at, you know, stories such as Jerry Francis at Leeds, you know, and that determination to make it to, you know, England to be a footballer and to predate, you know, Albert Johansson. There are a lot of people never realised, I didn't realise, you know, until I read it, you know, and it's an utterly brilliant piece of social history.
Can I just mention you said, who do you think you are? I'm sure Viv Anderson won't mind me mentioning this, but when I interviewed Viv, I'd done a lot of background into his family history, and I think he was quite taken aback by, you know, his history really, and a lot of it he wasn't really sure of, and he was able to share it with his mum, which was really lovely because his mum died not long afterwards. So I'm glad, at least I hope she got the chance to remember some of her ancestors. And it was the same with the Chamberlain family. Neville Chamberlain was the first black peer at Newport and Port Vale.
Yeah, that was one of the chapters that made a big impression on me. I loved that chapter in particular. But so go on.
Well, I mean, it's pretty certain that we trace the family back to a plantation called Mullet Hall in Jamaica. And given that one of the previous owners of that plantation was called Chamberlain, there's every chance that the family that we track back were the ancestors of the Chamberlain footballing dynasty, but they were actually enslaved people working for a man called Chamberlain. So it was quite amazing really to think of the progress that had been made and what that family have achieved. And a lot of it is down to their parents, the people who came across with the Windrush generation. Story after story is, Viv Anderson's family is another example. You know, people came across as Windrush generation, very, very difficult beginnings, built up a home, brought up their family, and they went on to success. So, you know, a lot of social history in there.
I mean, the Andersons family is a very, very good example of the Windrush generation, to be honest, because as Bill said, I think Audley Anderson came across to this country in 1954. We were even able to tell Viv the name of the ship that he came across on. He settled in Nottingham, and then he sent for his wife. This was a common Windrush theme. They sent for their wives once they'd settled. And she was a qualified teacher in Jamaica. And she got here and she was told, no, those qualifications count for nothing here. And that was, again, that was a common theme. People coming across from the Caribbean as trained teachers and nurses being told that their qualifications were worthless. Myrtle Anderson, I think, eventually got a job as a dinner lady in a school. So she did end up in a school, but as a dinner lady. And to her very great credit, she then retrained as a nurse and worked in the NHS. So I think the Anderson story is a wonderful one. And of course, Viv, of all the players in our book, in footballing terms, Viv has probably achieved more than anybody else.
We'll come on to Viv Anderson, actually. He's someone that I want to come on to. But just before that, guys, I suppose a little bit really about the origins of black players. We're sort of looking, the turn of the 20, end of the 19th, turn of the 20th century, Walter Tull, Arthur Wharton, some of these names may be known. They certainly weren't known by my students. I know that until I sort of got hold of them. But, just a little bit, because obviously, Viv Anderson, Cyril Regis, Laurie Cunningham, those players, Brendan Batts, those names are synonymous, certainly with Stephen and I's generation, but it goes so much further back than that.
Yeah.
Do you want to go first, Bill, or shall I?
You go first, David.
I think the point I was going to make about that really was how diverse the stories are. I mean, you've only got to look at the first couple of players chronologically in the book to realise how different they are. I mean, Arthur Wharton, I think everybody accepts Arthur Wharton was the first black professional footballer anywhere in the world. Well, he came from a very middle-class background on the west coast of Africa, an area that is now part of Ghana. His father was a Methodist minister. And Arthur Wharton came over here to be educated and to train to be a Methodist minister. Unfortunately, from the family's point of view, when he got here, he turned out to be exceptionally good at sport. And I'm afraid he never did become a Methodist minister, no doubt much to the disappointment of his parents. But that's one story. But then if you look at another player, two or three later in chronological terms, you come to Walter Tull, and he was one of the ones he had a grandfather who was an enslaved man on Barbados. And Walter's father came to this country and settled in the Folkestone area. So in those two stories, you've got two very diverse versions of how people came to be here and how they came to be footballers.
Gary, I'll come to you next. And like I say, I guess, this isn't the never sit, and this is probably my as much as I like to sort of claim knowledge, certainly in front of my students if they're listening to this, but this is a story that's not been in chunks where it's become, I don't want to say you use the word fashionable, but it sort of comes into the public conscience and then disappears again. But this book particularly shows that, and pioneers is a great word, that it just shows that this has been an ongoing, and as you mentioned, still an ongoing struggle, like say for the best part of 120 years.
Yeah, it has. And it's interesting just hearing Bill and David talking about the different types different stories within what is easily sort of otherwise grouped as black players. And there's lots of different people in there, lots of different stories, lots of different backgrounds and how they came to be professional footballers. But yeah, it's as you say, it's a story that sort of keeps raising its head in public consciousness every now and then, and often because there's been a case of racism, perhaps like Balotelli in Italy, or when Lukaku went out to Syria. I mean, in the sort of 70s, I had a friend who was a West Bromwich fan, and we used to go up to watch the Baggies play. And this is the era of Batson, Murray Cunningham, Cyril Regis, Remy Moses, that sort of thing. And you know, and then again, as I say, I sort of grew up in a sort of multiracial area of Warsaw, very working class, very sort of unpretentious. And it was nothing unusual for me. And because they were playing, these guys were playing for the Baggies at the Baggies ground, there was very little, although there was some, very little, very little racial abuse. I just want to sort of just flag up something contemporary. I mean, and although the football club where I live now in Spain, Torrevieja, went bust a month ago, we used to go and watch them play, and they had a group of expat supporters called the Torre Army. And there used to be quite a lot of them, but there was down to about a dozen or 15 of them. And Torrevieja had a centre-forward, a guy called Omar, who came across from Morocco, I think. And a really, really good, work his socks off, good striker, scored a lot of goals for us. And we used to sit fairly close to these dozen or so people. And they would be all sort of retired, but so they'd be sort of 60s, 70s sort of thing. So perhaps a generation before me. But they used to describe him as that black man. And it just sort of used to really irritate me and the wife. We went and sat somewhere else away from after a while. But it just shows that these sort of things, they don't go away because prejudices are sort of become inculcated into people quite early in life. And once it's there, unless there's something dramatic happen to shake it off, it'll keep happening again and again. And that's just another example.
Yeah.
It is. And can I just ask you, guys, you know, I mean, Bill, if you, you know, I don't know if you want to answer this one, but in terms of sort of major shifts within the sort of stories and the narrative, because obviously I'm guessing you didn't approach this in a chronological order. You must have approached it almost in club order, I guess. Yeah. But did you, as the book was coming together and the more and more information was gathered, did you start to see, did you get a better understanding of the nature of what black players faced at various times through history?
Yes, I think we did, and it did change over time. I mean, I was just looking at the, it was very, very slow progress to begin with between Arthur Wharton in 1886, and the end of the Second World War, there were only about 10 black players. So, you know, it was slow. And of those 10, if two of them were Egyptians, so let's just leave them for a minute, only one of the players was actually born abroad with two black parents. So most of them were born in Britain and most of them were of mixed heritage. And I mean, now Arthur Wharton's very famous, Walter Tull's very famous, but they probably didn't influence any black boys in their day because nobody had heard of them. It's only the last few years that they've been, you know, resurrected and got the acclaim they deserve. And Jack Leslie, the guy who was picked for England then dropped because he was black, for 9 years he was the only black player in the Football League. And when another one came along, Eddie Parris, who ended up being Wales's first black player, the newspapers couldn't believe it because it was a prospect of two black players in the same game. So, you know, these guys are very, very lonely, and there were lots of gaps between, you know, black players coming along. So it was very slow progress. And they really, because they were, you know, outnumbered so badly, they had to put up with bad treatment. Walter Tull took an awful lot of abuse in one particular game at Bristol City, so much so that Tottenham probably quietly shifted him off onto Northampton because they didn't know how to deal with that sort of thing. They were always referred to as darkie. They didn't have a choice about that. Even the newspapers referred to them as darkie. So, you know, they didn't have a lot of respect, but they didn't really have anybody to support them. They were very, very lonely.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've touched a couple of times on how did we write the book or how should you read the book. I mean, I think, to be honest, it was not quite as systematic as you made it sound. It was a little bit random. Essentially, I think we picked a player and then we followed that player's career. So, I mean, I, for instance, wrote about Tony Collins, and he was the first black player at several clubs. I followed his career around the clubs, and I was writing about him as he went. Bill and I did talk about the ways in which we might present the material. I mean, we decided that for football fans, it was probably sensible to present it by club in alphabetical order, and that's what we've done. But, I mean, we did talk quite seriously about presenting the book material in chronological order, and I've said all along, I think that would have given the book a different flavour. It would have brought that sort of social history theme more to the fore. I'm happy with the way we did it, but I mean, at the moment, if you want to follow the historical storyline, the thread, you have to jump backwards and forwards throughout the book. But there is a sort of social history theme there, but it's buried within the chapters at the moment. It could have been brought out more, although I'm happy with the way we did do it.
I love the way you do it. I'm going to ask Stephen as well, because obviously, you know, you mentioned this whole ricocheting thing, and I think, Stephen, you know, you summed it up perfectly in that choose your own adventure. And certainly, you know, I went to Ray Diamond, the whole City player first. That's where I wanted to go. And then as I looked down the list, and I recognised, and I think it's, forgive my pronunciation, but Lindy Delafina.
Della Penna,
sorry, I apologise. But once I saw his name multiple times, I was like, okay, I need to read about him first, because he was almost a pioneer at three different clubs. So he struck my attention straight away. But like you said, Stephen, it's almost better to learn through choice, because you're more inclined to absorb the information than doing it in almost a chronological historical textbook order. I think this way works far better in terms of retaining the information, but also in picking your own way through this particular history.
Yeah, because I found that I did it in a lot of different manners. Although I ricocheted all over the place, I did it from obviously going to your own teams first, and then I'd look at kind of the teams surrounding. So as a Liverpool fan, obviously Howard Gale, and I know about Howard Gale, but I always want to read about Howard Gale. So, you know, did Howard Gale first, and then I kind of like ricocheted around the Merseyside clubs and the closer area. And then there would be certain names that would crop up, and I would ricochet to a certain name, and then I'd notice the club. And then I'd think, oh, right, wouldn't it be interesting to know about those players that played for teams that were synonymous for racism. You know, or certain areas of the country that were much more, what's the word I'm looking for here, much more intolerant, you know, rather than kind of like the big cities, kind of like the provincial areas. And then it changed the more that I swept around. And then within that, you start to pick up on players that you've not known of before. You know, for instance, like the story of Lloyd Maitland was just absolutely mind-blowing. I mean, I don't want to give...
I love Lloyd.
Lloyd was just my utter favourite. I mean, I think I've already said he had a different favourite chap, but it was because you as soon as you remember another player and another story, you think, oh, my God. But the Lloyd Maitland story just absolutely blew me away. You know, it was absolutely, you know, astonishing. You know, it's things like Albert Payne at Tranmere Rovers as well. And it's, you know, Tranmere's first black player, you know, significantly predating Everton and Liverpool's first black players, Liverpool in particular. You know, it wasn't until 1980. There were so many, you know, and I was drawn very early to Paul Canoville, for instance, because of that aspect of being that kid of the 80s. And I always remember those games during an era when it was first start of kind of live first division games being on the television, and the BBC used to show games on a Friday night, and ITV would show a game on a Sunday afternoon, and it wasn't week in, week out, so there was that sense of occasion to it. And I well remember a Chelsea Everton game on BBC one Friday night, and not being able to understand the reception that Canoville was getting from his own supporters, because, you know, for me as a child, it was just a case of, you know, these are footballers, and why would, you know, they're playing for your own team, why would you boo them? Why would you, you know, make those noises towards them? So for me, I was drawn to, you know, the familiar, which made it feel sensory. But at the same time, you know, that exploration of finding out about players you'd never heard of before and the remarkable stories behind them, you know, no one more so than Lloyd Maitland.
Yeah, I mean, having said that the clubs weren't terribly helpful, I really must say the players themselves were wonderful. Ray Daniel, what a lovely, lovely man. He's probably a neighbour of Gary. He lives in Spain now. And, of course, Lloyd Maitland, he had his career ended in a tragic way, and yet there wasn't an ounce of bitterness in him, you know. And, yeah, we met some really, really nice people amongst the players.
I think somebody said earlier about how they were sort of oblivious to racism in the game because of the background they came from. And I think I was a bit like that, to be honest. I was actually at the game where Paul Cannavale made his debut. It was at Selhurst Park. And to be honest, the stories said, you know, he was jeered by his own fans as he warmed up and came onto the pitch as a late sub. I don't remember that. I mean, I was there, but I don't remember it. Perhaps there's no particular reason why I should. However, Bill and I were in a pub just a few weeks ago with a Chelsea fan who also said he was there, and he vividly remembered. He said he walked out. He was so disgusted by the behaviour of some of the Chelsea fans that he left the ground. He couldn't bear to be in the same ground as them. So, I mean, memories are funny things. I mean, I kind of feel as though I must have been present at quite a few racist incidents, but they just didn't sink in or didn't register.
Chelsea were very much the exception, though. They were the only club, really, I think, that booed their own players. A lot of players said that Millwall was the most racist ground they ever went to, but Millwall never, ever booed their own black players. And Ray Daniel made that point to me. He said he never understood the logic as to why people booed the opposing black players when their team had one or two black players in them as well. It just defies any logic.
Yeah,
it is. Well, I can remember Ray Daniel coming to Hull. I just moved to Hull at the same time. I'd just come across. I was about 14, 15, and I'd started going to Hull. And his first season coincided with my first season there as well. And some of the stuff on the terraces at Boothry Park, I mean, it's not everyone. And obviously that's, you know, it's not every football fan. It's a minority. But because I'd never been to I'd seen it on the TV, but it was the first sort of football ground, certainly the first football league ground I'd spent any time in. And I found it shocking, you know, that some of the things you would hear. But I guess, guys, Bill, I'll come to you. Obviously, as we sort of progress through sort of time, and obviously there's sort of no getting away from Brazil's emergence as a world force, you know, 58, 62, 70, you know, and obviously the game is becoming more global. You know, people are seeing, certainly in 1970, almost a completely different variation of the game, and you have this side, you know, and the greatest player in the world is actually a black player, you know, with Pelé. And in your opinion, you know, is there a shift in the appreciation of, I'm not saying a tolerance, but is there an appreciation in the ability of black footballers? You know, is there any pattern, or does it coincide with the emergence of Brazil at all?
Well, I did have a look at that, and in all honesty, there's no evidence that it did. And I'm not quite sure why that is, whether the 58 side wasn't seen by enough people. But there's no sort of spike, say, 10 years later, where there's a lot of new black players coming to the English game. So it's hard to find any evidence for that. I mean, probably one of the most significant events after the 58 World Cup was, you probably know the Sweden manager, George Rayner. They got to the final, and he left to join Skegness in the Midland League, which is bizarre. And his first signing was Charlie Williams, who was Doncaster's first black player. So I don't know. Gary will remember Charlie Williams, the comedian and entertainer. I don't know whether you young guys will.
Yep, no, I remember. Yeah, right. Exactly who you mean.
Yeah. So, I mean, I just thought that was a bizarre event, that the manager of the World Cup runners-up should go and join Skegness immediately afterwards. The 62 side, again, there's probably no evidence of a great big spike of interest afterwards, but that's not to say there wasn't. Obviously, the 70 side was absolutely fantastic as well. So, you know, probably the first player that a lot of black players say they've modelled themselves on is Clyde Best. Albert Johansson is probably the first high-profile black player, you know, back in the sort of early 60s when I think Match of the Day started about 1965. Albert was a fairly high-profile player. There was the Beatles, George Best and so on. So, no, I mean, logically, if somebody watched Brazil play, they're going to think that's fantastic. They've got black players just like me. I'm going to copy them. But I couldn't find any hard evidence of that.
Now, I think for me, I wouldn't choose Pelé, to be honest. I think it's to do with the timing. I mean, I went to my first match in 1963. The first big international thing that I can remember, of course, is the 1966 World Cup finals. And Pelé wasn't particularly good at that, mainly because he'd been kicked. He was kicked all over the park. But the player who was good was Eusebio. So, I mean, the first black player who made a big impression on me, I think, was Eusebio. He was fantastic.
I mean, Gary, I'll sort of come to you on this one. You know, sort of as we move through, and it's a great point there. I actually mentioned Eusebio and the 66 World Cup, and I just sort of want to bring that forward and sort of try and tie it in as best I can, you know, with Viv Anderson. But do you think? And I apologise for this question, Gary. Do you think that the recognition and playing for a national team was more important and perhaps did more for the I won't say the appreciation, but for the acceptance of black players in the game?
Yeah, I guess the short answer is yes, it did. The longer answer is no, it blooming well shouldn't have done. But yes, it did. I remember we were talking a while ago to Lindsay Hooper about women's football, if you remember, Stu.
Yeah.
And we were talking about this woman who'd been appointed as a coach at Forest Green. And it was big news, and she was so irritated. It shouldn't be big news. And it's very much the case that, you know, Viv Anderson playing for England shouldn't be big news because he was black. And I think it was, would it be Ron Greenwood managing at the time? And I think when he took over the job, there was an issue about when he was selecting Anderson, and he said something along the lines of, I don't care which colour they are, whether they're black, yellow, green, orange or purple. I can't remember the exact quote, something of that ilk. You actually said, I just pick the best players, because you're actually don't fall into the trap of defining the question, and you're sort of accepting the difference when there should be no difference there. So I think, as I said, the short answer is yes, the longer answer is no, it damn well shouldn't have been.
Could I just tip us back? Sorry.
Go ahead.
Just to get a feel for what life was like then. In 1975, a very famous serious journalist called Bernard Joy wrote that there was a prospect of West Germany playing a black international. And he wrote a long piece to say that almost certainly will never happen in England. We'll never have a black player. This is 75, remember? And he says the reason we won't have them is their temperament isn't right. They can't cope with the playing conditions. They won't be able to tolerate the barracking. And they're no good at physical contact. Jeez. And that was only 3 years before Viv Anderson broke that barrier and showed that players can, or black players can, do all of those things. And oddly enough, I don't know if you noticed, but last week before England-Wales, Rhys James became the 100th black player since 1978. Yeah. So, you know, we're getting there.
It's funny you say that, actually, Bill. This was the thing that my students couldn't grasp, that the things that I was talking about was in my lifetime. They couldn't grasp the concept that what I was trying to tell them, and certainly that sort of mid to late 70s, they just couldn't grasp that. I don't know how old they think I am, but that was happening in my lifetime. They just could not wrap their heads around it. It was, you know, they sort of saw it as, you know, decades and decades ago, you know, things that they couldn't possibly relate to. But it's like, this is my lifetime, you know, and these are the things that I would perhaps see on television, or this is what witnessed. And that was the thing they struggled with, was how sort of up to date it was. And, you know, and I'll say some, go speak to your parents, you know, if you've got mum or dad, you know, who's interested in the game, go and ask them. And one of the lads' dad was a Millwall fan. Season ticket holder at Millwall, sort of late 70s, early 80s. And when he came back the next week, he was like, oh, my dad's told me some stories. And I was like, yeah, I bet he has. But that was sort of, you know, that really was where they struggled. But I'm interested, you know, you got, you know, Viv Anderson did the foreword. Does does he have, what's his appreciation of his sort of position and standing in the game with regards to this, you know, being the first black player for England?
Well, he certainly understands the importance because, as you probably remember, it was a really big issue at the time. The press was speculating for months in advance who might become the first black player because Laurie Cunningham was in the frame as well. And when he made his debut, there were lots of television interviews. The Queen sent him a telegram. Elton John sent him a telegram. So he was aware it was a big event. I think he's proud of that in a very modest way. You know, he's a very, very nice man. So I think he is conscious of what he achieved without being boastful about it. But I was asking Viv, because we talked about, I think it was Gary sort of hinted that racism hasn't really gone away. And I've said to quite a few of the players, it seemed to be getting better. And they said, no, Bill, you know, it never actually went away. It was always there. So I think there's still a lot of work to be done to eradicate racism, if that's ever possible. Just come back to Viv. He played in a day when black players got no support. They were expected to put up with the bananas and the pears and so on getting thrown at them. And I asked him, you know, what would have happened if you'd walked off? And he just laughed. And he said, if I'd walked off, he says, I would have been signing on the next Monday. You know, I couldn't have done that. So, I mean, I think now if there was racism like that, the players would walk off and I think they would get support. So that's certainly progress.
Gary.
It's interesting, you know, it said about Rhys Jones being the 100th black player, and you know, and that's a mark of progress. I'm not saying that, but nobody remembers who was the 100th left-handed player. Nobody remembers who was the 100th blonde player.
Yeah.
Nobody remembers who was the 100th oldest child. I mean, all I'm saying is, and I appreciate it is a thing. But it actually shouldn't. It shouldn't be a thing.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah, that was no criticism intended, Mike. No. I just said, it's an easy trap for society to fall into, isn't it?
Yeah, it should be the norm, shouldn't it? We shouldn't notice. So it's like David not noticing, you know. I mean, there's two of the players in the book. I was at their debut game, but I don't remember them. I don't remember a black player coming on with,
I'm going to come to you, Stephen, because obviously, you know, obviously as a Liverpool fan, and that's, you know, that's the, you know, the iconic picture of, you know, with John Barnes and the banana. And I guess, you know, as a Liverpool fan, and this is, you know, this is not meant as, you know, it's Liverpool fans. It was just that image almost seemed to embody everything that was happening in the game at that time. It was almost caught within a single photograph. You know, as a Liverpool fan, is it something that you're proud of, is the wrong word, but it sort of almost brought it to a head. Does that make sense?
Yes, there was a perceived turning point, I'd probably say there. certainly in that aspect that we've just spoken about, how that lack of support suddenly changed. You know, suddenly there was, you know, people did sit up and take notice and say, hang on a minute. You know, these human beings here being treated, you know, horrendously. You know, so I think right-minded people started to take, you know, a greater interest and a greater role in saying, look, this isn't right. You know, I can remember going to Anfield and John Barnes being booed in a Watford shirt. You know, I remember John Barnes being signed and graffiti on the wall at Melwood and Anfield saying Liverpool is white. And it was absolutely shameful. I've heard a story of one of Barnes, I think it was Barnes' home debut. And very early on, he pulled one of those great trademark turns and he was off and away. And there's two old fellas in flat hats, flat caps, and one of them turns to the other and says, oh, maybe he's not as black as we thought he was. And it's shocking, but at the same time, it's that kind of generation that something like that would trip off the tongue quite so readily. It was said, believably, part tongue-in-cheek, but at the same time, you know, not. So within that respect, it took one turn for John Barnes to change the perceived generational thoughts of two old men. You know, even in the, just the smallest of natures, but you know, that that concept of John Barnes coming into Liverpool and changing a lot of thinking from a lot of people, and but not changing some people. You know, racism still goes on. It's still, you know, a stain on society. But like it's just been said, that lack of support, you know, started to change at that point in time. I felt, you know, more people come on side and would be willing to speak up in a football stadium if they heard racist chanting or comments, that people would shout it down. You know, it's probably at this point that I can remember at Anfield people being told to shut up, you know, with that type of comment. And that, you know, it was the concept of, you know, black players in opposing shirts coming to Anfield and still being booed and saying, well, no, you can't do that. You know, you're not booing a Liverpool player in a, you know, black player in a Liverpool shirt. You know, you will attack people for booing him, but then you will boo an opposition player. And it just started to make people think in a very, very, you know, different manner. What was acceptable, what isn't acceptable, you know, and it shouldn't have taken someone of such supreme talent to make people think differently. You know, that should have just been a given.
It's something that I want to ask you as well. You know, it's a great point that Stephen makes there, but I'll ask you, David, is when you spoke to the players, first of all, did at the time, did they see themselves as pioneers within the sort of club environment that they went into? But secondly, has their perception changed of what they did and what they achieved, you know, over time, as they've had time to look back on it? Has their perception of what they did, you know, have they become, I don't know, proud of what they did? You know, can they see it for, you know, were they lost in it at the time and were just professional footballers and it was a paid job? You know, do they have a better appreciation now of what they were doing for future generations?
I suspect the answer to that is probably yes. I mean, Bill interviewed probably more players than I did, but I mean, I think the at the time, I'm guessing, and I think it's probably right, you're just doing a job. You want to play football and you just want to do everything you can to be in the team next week. I don't think you're thinking of yourself as a pioneer. You're thinking of yourself as somebody who wants to be a professional footballer. And yes, you know, you've got more obstacles to overcome than the white teammates on either side of you. But nonetheless, that is your sole objective. And you sort of certainly see comments from players say, you know, I was oblivious to the abuse. You know, I was so focused on the game, I didn't hear it. But you do get other players who said, well, actually, you could hear every word. So I think different players reacted differently to the abuse. I'd be quite surprised if many of them actually thought of themselves at the time in terms of being pioneers. I think looking back on it, they may well sort of regard their sort of pioneering status with a great deal more pride than they felt at the time. And for instance, I know that Bill interviewed Chris Kamara, and I believe Chris said to Bill that he hadn't realised he was the first black player at Swindon. So I don't think Chris appreciated his pioneering status at Swindon. And I guess many of the others didn't either. Looking back on it now, that's probably an entirely different story. And I think Chris Kamara, for instance, would be very proud of the trail that he blazed. And there's no doubt that black players today stand on the shoulders of these giants, because without people blazing that trail, you know, it would still be hellishly difficult for players today to make that breakthrough.
Yeah, I want to ask about that as well, Bill, in terms of, you know, the bravery, I suppose, of some of these players. You know, again, was there an appreciation that maybe there is now? And certainly when you see Ian Wright interviewed or Dion Dublin, you know, and they talk about these players, they talk about Cyril Regis, Brendan Batson, you know, they were the sort of true pioneers. You know, they were the ones who sort of almost committed first, if you like. You know, did they have an appreciation of the bravery that they were demonstrating to future players?
They certainly didn't at the time. I think, as David said, what the ones that made it, what they shared was an absolute love for football. They would have put up with anything to be able to play football. There were a couple that went by the wayside. I'm thinking of Carl Francis at Birmingham, Don Gardner at Wolves, only played two or three games and they were fantastic prospects. And I'm not sure how much the, you know, the racism and the abuse was responsible for their very short careers. But they, I think looking back now, they realised that they were very brave. But at the time, all they wanted to do was play football under any circumstances. And Winston White told me a story. Winston was Leicester's first black player. And he was playing a friendly match at Millwall and he was warming up. And apparently he was taking the usual sort of abuse that players got there. And when he got on the coach after the game, Jimmy Bloomfield said, I want to see you when we get back to Leicester. And he thought he'd done something wrong. And he went into the office and Bloomfield said, how did you feel when you warmed up? He says, what do you mean? How did I feel? Well, how did you feel all the abuse? And he says, I never heard anything, boss. And Bloomfield says, you'll do for me. You'll make it. So, you know, it's they were oblivious. They tried to block it out of their minds.
Another player I was going to mention in that context was Rowley Gregoire at Bill's own team. I mean, Rowley, I think, was a very big prospect. I mean, Bill's a better place to talk about it than I am. But he only played about a dozen times for Sunderland. And I think, you know, me reading Bill's chapter about Sunderland, I mean, it's at least possible that the racist abuse that he experienced was what drove him from the game and caused him to have such a short career. So there were people who could hack it. And unfortunately, there were those who it broke them, to be honest.
And I suppose that's it as well, Gary. You know, this, you know, the sort of the sad side of this, but, you know, we talk about the bravery, you know, and this pioneering ethic that sort of permeates through this book. But I guess there's probably another book of all the, you know, of all the great players and the potential great players who didn't make it. And it's not through a lack of ability. It's not through a lack of talent. You know, it's ultimately, not through the colour of the skin, but it's ultimately because it was made so difficult for them and so much more difficult than it should ever be. And it's such a, you know, it's such a shame that there are players who could have graced the game that we'll never know about.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. You know, I guess, you know, to become a professional footballer in any era, I mean, more so perhaps now because of the sort of academies and the sort of sweeping up of talent and then that gets cast aside afterwards. To become a professional footballer is a massive task. And, you know, to put 17 more hurdles in front of somebody who has the talent to do it, you know, must be absolutely soul-destroying. It's one of those things that you do. You know, how many great talents have been lost? There'll be some. I mean, and it won't be three, it won't be seven. It'll be a lot more than that. And, you know, you and I have done a lot of political football podcasts, Stu, and, you know, we sort of say quite often how much, you know, football is like a mirror of society. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think this is another example, you know, I don't think racism is nil of football. I think racism is nil of society and it's just mirrored in football because that's perhaps one of the more obvious places where it materialises. But yeah, it must be some sort of tragic losses of talent that never had the chance to flourish because people were beaten down by the bigotry and hatred.
At some point we are going to have to sort of wrap this up, but not yet. Clearly not yet. But another aspect of this then, and again, it's something, you know, in the current day and age, and we like to think we're progressive and it's moving forward and it's getting better. But, you know, obviously, you know, the sort of lack of black coaches and black managers, be it in the English game, the game across the UK, or, you know, or even going into Europe as well. Was that ever discussed by the players in terms of, had there have been a black coach, or, you know, things will improve if there are black, you know, within the management structure, that things would improve even more so?
Not so much in their career, but almost without exception, we talked about the lack of black coaches, black managers now. And there were a lot of theories as to why things haven't improved. Because when Viv Anderson wrote the foreword, he pointed out that in 1993... he was one of two black managers. And now we fast forward, 27 years, and we haven't really got that many more than two now, have we? The theories they came up with, I mean, they all make sense. One of them is that there are no black owners of football clubs, and there are probably very, very few black people in the, they call it upstairs, but I suppose they mean the director's box. And I think until you've got black owners and people in positions that know black people, then it is going to be quite difficult. A lot of them said that people don't trust black managers. And you know, a lot of black players are desperate to get into coaching and management. Dwight York's name kept coming up, Andy Cole, Sol Campbell. I know Sol Campbell's had opportunities, but the argument there was he's always been given almost impossible tasks to carry out. And Chris Hughton's name came up time after time after time, you know, that he was never in the frame for better jobs. Quite often they would talk about, they would much rather appoint a failed English white manager than take what they would see a chance on a black manager. And Neville Chamberlain came up with a theory that it's actually the black players' fault because they don't apply for jobs because they think they're wasting their time. So, you know, should they be doing more to apply? And of course, the Rooney Rule came up, and everybody thought the Rooney Rule should be applied, as long as it wasn't simply lip service. So it's definitely a topic that's very, very active, and the old black players have got lots of ideas as to how we should be getting more black managers into position.
It's, I mean, it's funny, you know, the Rooney Rule, like you say, it's so open to, like you just said there, to lip service. You know, for the Rooney Rule to truly work, it has to be genuine, and it has to be meant, and it has to actually serve the purpose and not just be a box ticking exercise.
Yeah.
It's interesting that the one thing about the Rooney Rule is it'll only work if the Rooney Rule isn't needed.
Yeah. Oh, Gary, you see, we could have ended on that one. No, it's fine. Maybe we'll edit it. I'll have Andrew Lewis in to say, can you put that in at the end as well? Stephen, I'll come to you on this one as well. And it's, I suppose, really, what you know, you could argue that we're sort of now looking for our next almost group of pioneers, but this time it is about management upstairs, the boardroom, ownership. We're sort of, you know, Les Ferdinand is very, you know, very vocal about this in terms of boardroom in football league clubs and the sort of the diverse makeup of boardrooms. And I guess this is now where, not say where we need to start looking, but I guess this is where pioneers are needed again, as much as we've all agreed, you know, they shouldn't be. This is not, you know, I'm not saying this book should never be written. Obviously, if you're looking at a history of players, that's fine. But in terms of some of the social issues that come with it, you know, it's not something we should be talking about. But unfortunately, we are going to need, or the game needs, sorry, a new generation of pioneers, but at a management level, ownership level, and boardroom level.
It does. I mean, it's kind of back to square one again. It's kicking in doors once again, and overturning the accepted norms that aren't all that normal, basically. It is a, you know, a huge disgrace on the English game. You know, I think you look at, yes, you know, we've already mentioned Chris Hughton. He's been a fine Premier League manager. You know, with some of his dismissals from the jobs that he's had have been massively harsh, where I've sat there and thought, you know, would a white manager be, you know, jettisoned quite so readily? And the answer, as often in my mind, formulated as no. So, you know, you look at the skill and the experience and the know-how that so many, you know, incredible black players have accumulated over the years, the experiences, the coaches that they've served under, you know, the games that they played in, the honours that they've won. Yet all of this experience is going to waste. It's not being imparted onto another, you know, another generation of younger players. And why? Why is that not happening?
I'll ask, you know, you sort of this question. I mean, are we at a stage now where we're already writing off, you know, the current generation of club owners at board level? You know, are we now onto the sort of, are we now waiting for the future generation? So if we look at current black players and now, are there, you know, do our hopes lie at that level now? You know, have we already written off this current generation in terms of starting to turn this around at that level within the game?
I don't know. And if the answer is yes, I don't know why the answer is yes. And if the answer is yes, I don't know what the solution is for the next generation either. It's a really difficult question because, you know, it's not financial because, you know, so many, I mean, every club, every Premier League club has so many black players. I mean, you know, we've got, I'm a Chelsea fan, you know, we've got so many black players in our squad. And yeah, so it's not so they don't trust people to play. Is it that they don't trust people to coach from that? Is a different setup from there? If you're an administrator, a director, or an owner of a football club, you can't be that damn stupid. Surely, I mean, it just almost beggars belief. And it was interesting that one of the guys there mentioned about perhaps there's a thing where a lot of black players don't apply for jobs because they think they're not going to get them. I mean, I don't know if that's true, but it might be, and that perhaps might be an issue as well. But I don't see any reason why there's so many talented black players. I mean, I remember Paul Inspeen becoming manager, and you're thinking, oh, this guy's going to do well. Now, I don't know whether it was because he was black that he didn't get the chance. So, I mean, he went and managed a couple of clubs, but sort of didn't last very long. It baffles me. It genuinely baffles me as to why there are no... you mentioned Chris Hughton. I mean, obviously, as Stevie said, God, desperately unlucky, been given the E by clubs at ridiculous times. I can't for the life of me understand why black players don't get, I mean, we call them managers, we call them head coaches, whatever you want to call them these days, don't get these positions. I just genuinely don't understand. And as you say, are we waiting for the generation? If so, why? I don't know what the solution is.
I mean, I'll ask you this question, David. You may not know this, but in terms of, you know, if we go further out onto the continent with regards to black coaches, black managers, and you know, is the UK very much typical of, you know, European football and its attitude towards, you know, former players or black coaches and black managers, or, you know, are we ahead? Are we behind? You know, how do we sit within sort of the rest of Europe on this subject?
Right, I think Bill said at the beginning, I think it would be very unwise for me to kind of speculate on that. I don't know enough about the European soccer scene and the management in the European soccer scene to give you an honest or worthwhile answer to that. I mean, in terms of the why question here, I mean, I'm quite strong on the fact, you know, it's not specifically a football issue, it's a societal issue. There is systemic racism in this country. There always has been. It hasn't gone away. It's still there. And, you know, black people are held back in all sorts of walks of life. I mean, my wife, for instance, when she went to her careers off lady at school and asked, what do you think I could do as a by way of a career? She was told she could be a dinner lady, or she could go and work on a shop counter. She went on to actually do a sort of 30 or 40 years in teaching, but that was not an option that was put to her at all. And I heard, there are countless examples of people speaking about that kind of restriction of the opportunities being offered to them. I'm not going to be able to remember the name of that vicar that you sent round a video earlier today, Bill. Pitt.
Eve Pitts, yeah.
Eve Pitts. I mean, a wonderful interview she did, but she was talking about the opportunities that she was offered at school. She was from Nottingham, and she was told to go and work stitching lace. I mean, Nottingham obviously had a huge lace industry. And people like her were told, you know, that's the only opportunity you've got. Go and work making lace. The opportunities that she wanted to take up, you know, perhaps in teaching, were not offered to her. And that's just fairly standard. Now, that's going back, admittedly, sort of 40 or 50 years for people like Eve Pitts. But I think those restrictions are still there. I don't think they've gone away. And there's lots of talk at the moment about Black Lives Matter. But you know, we shouldn't have, we shouldn't be having to talk about Black Lives Matter, you know, in 2020. It should be a case of all lives matter. Yes, of course. The reason Black Lives Matter is so talked about and so important at the moment is because it's self-evident at the moment that not all lives are equal. Black lives don't matter as much as white lives. And that is just plain wrong. And until that is sorted out as a, you know, as a society, football's not going to change, you know, football can't change in isolation, I don't think, really.
Yeah, but can I just offer the, like you, I'm not an expert on Europe, but I know a man that is. And Romy Borkor, Accrington Stanley's first black player. Romy played in 75 different countries in his career. He's a Frenchman and he plays for Benin. And his attitude was that it seems to be okay to appoint black players as assistant coaches, but there seems to be this sort of barrier to making them, you know, in charge. So I don't know whether we count that as progress or not. But even Romy, you know, Romy's experience is that no, black people are not getting into the positions that perhaps they deserve to be.
Okay, I mean, you may want to edit this out because it's not really about football. But I mean, I was on a Zoom meeting, and one of the speakers at it was Stuart Lawrence, the brother of the murdered teenager Stephen Lawrence. And Stuart Lawrence spoke very, very sensibly and very maturely about, you know, whether things are getting better, and he venture to suggest that perhaps things were a little bit better than they had been at the time his brother was murdered. And there were quite a lot of, you know, people on that call, you know, black people on that call who said, no, you're wrong, Stuart. It's just as bad as it ever was. So I don't think we've made as much progress as we like to think we have.
That won't be edited out, by the way. that's staying in. I suppose, last thing that, you know, Stephen, I just wanted to come to you, in, you know, with regards to the European thing, you know, as we've been chatting, and I was trying to think, you know, black coaches, and not all I'd come up with, but I'd got as far as Rijkaard Hullett and Edgar Davids to a certain extent, but, you know, is there, I'm not saying the Dutch are more tolerant, but is that purely down to luck? You know, that those three players were in the right place at the right time at the right clubs when managers were required, or is there maybe a more progressive nature within, perhaps within the Netherlands, within their culture and society? I'll throw you that difficult one at the end, Stephen, because you've had a quiet night.
Thank goodness for that. Oh, everyone's dodged a bullet there. No, I'd say when it comes to the Netherlands, that they are held up as the benchmark of intelligent football, and you know, Rijkaard and Hullett were part of a, you know, I hate the phrase golden generation, but they were part of that 1988 European Championship winning side, and you know, I think it was, you know, if anyone was going to break the glass ceiling, then they were the men to do it. Rijkaard, tellingly, you know, I think he had very little coaching experience when he took the Netherlands job, and then took them to within a penalty shootout of the European Championship final on home soil, and then you know, from there the Barcelona job came. I don't think he was the first choice, but you know, he got the job, and you know, after a difficult start, he moulded it well and won the European Cup, won the Liga titles. You know, he created an exciting team at the Camp Nou, that Ronaldinho side, and you know, the early emergence of Messi, and he was so synonymous with you know, such great football. You know, he left a fine foundation for Pep Guardiola to build upon. So yes, I think. They are footballing figures that kind of transcended, you know, any partition almost, you know, and why that should be the case, just simply on playing achievement, when others across the board from many nations could point to their own fantastic deeds as players, but not to be able to translate it into coaching opportunities at such high levels as well. For Rudd Hullett, you know, you could point to maybe in the right place at the right time to a degree. He got the job just as Glenn Hoddle left for the England job. he was probably the most high-profile arrival in English football at that time as a player. When he'd arrived in, what, 95? I think he'd had a year as a player. So, you know, I think there was a degree of being in the right place at the right time. The environment was probably quite ripe for it, and it was a huge step. And, you know, and in a way for Chelsea, it was something that went full circle from Paul Canoville. You know, if you look at it and think, you know, Paul Canoville being booed on a Friday night in front by his own supporters at Stamford Bridge in 1983-84, and then what, 13 years later, Rod Hullett, you know, they have a black manager. But within that, it is something that is offset by the fact that he, again, was dispensed very, very quickly. You know, Ken Bates didn't hang around and get in shut of him. I'm not saying for 1 minute that was because he was black. You know, there was clearly a personality issue between the two. And I'll always point to that moment on the top of the Wembley steps when Bates tried to give him some kind of cuddly toy and Hullett wasn't having it, as being one of the big instigators in that. But why that couldn't be replicated across the board from other nations, you know, beggars belief, and is a completely imponderable question. There's no answer to that. But, you know, yes, I do think that the likes of Hullett and Rijkaard just simply transcend all barriers. You know, they were part of that era that just gained an automatic respect because of the football. You know, people saw the football before they saw the person, before they saw the colour. You know, a generation before that, people were seeing the colour and then the player. I mentioned John Barnes and how he changed perceptions, but it took a player of immense talent to do so. This wasn't a workmanlike left-back or, a hoof-it centre-back. This is John Barnes, the most gifted player of his generation. But then suddenly here, you know, on the back of that, there's, you know, this image of Hullett and Van Basten and the beautiful football that they can play, and they translated it into coaching. So, you know, they stand there still as an anomaly. You know, it's still, you know, why not Davids? Davids should have done a whole lot more. You know, where's Seedorf? You know, it doesn't seem to have tripped onto the next generation.
I knew you'd be all right with that question. I knew if I could offload it onto you, you'd be fine with it. great answer, guys. We're nearly an hour and a half, which is brilliant, and I'm okay with that. But before we go, you know, ultimately, this is a book that is celebrating the first black players at each of the 93 football league clubs, as you mentioned at the beginning. So it would be remiss of me to sort of not come to you all in turn and sort of ask you for your favourite story. I know it's always difficult to pick a favourite. It's like you can't have a favourite son or child and all that. So I am aware of that. However, I'm going to make you pick anyway. So I'll start with you, Gary. I think you can have first pick tonight. So from the book, your favourite story, maybe not necessarily your favourite player, but your favourite story from the book.
Yeah, I'm sort of perhaps not thinking favourite, perhaps sort of most impressionable.
Okay.
But yeah, so I mean, I want to go with Mark Rees, because I'm a local hometown club, and I think Mark Rees was playing in 84 when Walsall played Liverpool.
Steve, yeah. Yes, he did.
He ran, yes. Alan Kennedy at Anfield. He ran Alan Kennedy ragged. I mean, he was never a great sort of dribble of the ball, but he had pace to burn. And I think Walsall got a 2-2 draw at Liverpool.
They did.
The semi-final of the League Cup, and came back to Fellows Park, and he had an injury. And but he played, but he wasn't fit, and he came off, I think, half-time or not just that long after. But I'm going to go with Paul Canavan. There's a couple of reasons why. I'm sort of fairly active on Facebook, and I'm fortunate to have a fair amount of fairly high-profile journo friends on Facebook and sort of a similar ilk. I'm friends with Paul Canaville on Facebook, and a very sort of very impressive guy, considering all the things he's gone through. And if anybody hasn't read his book, Black and Blue, that's a harrowing tale to read. I'm also sort of very active on Twitter. I've got a lot of sort of Chelsea fans in sort of my sort of Twitterati group. And Paul Canavale is highly regarded by these guys. And it's perhaps because the people I'm linked with, because if there's any racists, I probably wouldn't link them damn well anyway. But I think I'll go with Paul Canavale for those reasons. I'll say, if you get a chance to link him on Facebook or look up the work he does, absolutely so impressive. Especially considering the sort of thing he went through with, in his life and at Chelsea. Read his book. It's massively harrowing.
Can I just butt in and say Paul Canavale is still obviously very active in work to combat cancer. I think a couple of days ago, my wife bought some raffle tickets for a raffle where he's been involved in promoting a raffle at our local barber shop.
There's so much charity work. I say you wouldn't believe because you know about anybody. Does so much charity work. He's got his own foundation as well.
Stephen, I'll come to you next. As Gary mentioned, their favourite is probably the, I probably used the wrong word there. You know, you can go with anything you want, most inspirational, relate to, whatever it is. But in terms of your pick of the 93, what would you pick?
I was absolutely bowled over by Lloyd Maitland. You know, such an incredible story that, you know, I think I had to put the book down at that point just to absorb that story and then go back to it. So, you know, so many times you say about a book being, you know, page turn, you can't put it down. Sometimes there is a positive reason why you put it down, because it makes you just sit there and think for a minute. And this is what Lloyd Maitland did for me.
Okay, so brilliant. Guys, obviously this is your book. You have 91 to pick from. I guess you know these stories practically inside out now. David, I'll come to you first. You know, obviously, you know, the book is, you know, is such a passion. You know, like you say, it's 4 years of your life, and to have to distill it down to one favourite is really an awful thing to do, and I am really sorry. But I am going to need one.
Okay, well, I'm glad you gave us plenty of warning. I've decided to go with Calvin Simons, mainly because he's a player nobody will have heard of. He was Rochdale's first black player, and he only played one game for them, away at Barrow. You can't get much more romantic than that. he's a lovely guy. He was born on Bermuda. He came over here in his late teens, I think it was, to play for Rochdale. He was good at football on Bermuda, but can you imagine the difference between playing football in the sun of Bermuda to coming to Rochdale? I mean, he said his regular pre-match sort of training regime in Bermuda involved a dip in the ocean. Well, you wouldn't try that in Rochdale, I think, even if they had an ocean. He's a lovely man. He's still alive. I've spoken to him a couple of times in Bermuda. He's absolutely thrilled to be in the book. And to be honest, I think he is the sort of player we had in mind when we started doing this research. We'd never heard of him in particular, but one of the things we believed was that if we didn't capture these stories now, they would disappear forever. And in fact, I've started writing the Rochdale chapter fairly confident in the knowledge that Tony Collins would be Rochdale's first black player. And by chance, I went onto the Rochdale fans forum and I asked them. And to begin with, they went along with Tony Collins, but then a couple of old heads said, no, hang on a minute, let's not forget Calvin Simons. And I just feel that if we'd left this research a little bit longer, his name would have dropped off the radar. Now, you may say he only played one game, so what? But he's still a pioneer in my mind, and I'm going to vote for Calvin.
Brilliant. Oh, what a great answer. What a great answer that is. Bill, you now have the pick of obviously everything else.
Everything, yeah. Okay. Well, I'm going to go for Willie Clark, mainly because I think he's very underrated. Willie Clark was Aston Villa's first black player. He was a Scot. Played a lot of high standard junior football in Scotland before signing for Bristol Rovers for a season in the Southern League. Joined Villa. And at that time, Villa were probably the best team in the world. They'd won the championship 5 times. They'd just won consecutive titles. So he went in at the very, very highest level. He was the third black player to play in the Football League. But I think the thing that we really should be commemorating more is he's the very, very first black goal scorer in the Football League. He scored the winner in a 3-2 game at Everton on Christmas Day 1901. Sounds like a lovely day. It was raining, it was getting dark. They thought the game might not be able to be completed. And he netted the winner. And I think for that reason, he should go down in history. He had a decent career in football, 177 league games. Went on to be the first black player at Bradford City and the second black player at Lincoln. Oddly enough, Lincoln were the first team to have two black players. So Willie Clark it is for me.
Guys, it's been brilliant. You know, it's been as I knew it would be right at the start. You know, when we started talking about this and, you know, chatting with Stephen and Guy about how long this will probably last. Like I say, it's been an hour and a half, and it is absolutely flown by. The book is Football's Black Pioneers, and it's so much more than a book. It's a lesson. It's awareness. It's educational, it's interesting, it's important, it's all of these things. And although I think it's taken you 4 years, it's quite the legacy for you both to leave behind, I think is what I'd say.
Oh, that's fantastic. You know, we did write it for people to enjoy it, and we want to share it, and you know, we're very, very keen to do so. And yeah, also we want to celebrate these players' achievements and inspire others. And also learn from them. You know, we don't want to go back to those days. So, you know, hopefully, you know, young kids at school, they'll read it and think, wow, you know, this is brilliant. But thanks for the kind words.
Yeah, thank you. I very much echo everything Bill said there. Thank you.
Nothing to thank us for. Like I say, it's been absolutely wonderful. Gary, enjoyed it?
Yeah, brilliant. So I'd just like to say, you know, thanks Bill and David for writing that book, because somebody needs to write it. And now you're bringing it, everybody needs to read it, because it's so important to recognise these things. And, you know, if for nothing else, that there are so many different stories amongst that sort of collection that is often termed as black players. And they're just people, and they're all so different. But it's a great read, and I say read the book, guys, because it's a cracking read.
Stephen, I suppose, you know, last word with you. An important book, right?
Oh, very important book. No, like we said at the start, it's not just about football. It's you know, it's the social aspect of it and the historical bearing of it, and the fact that so much of it is relevant to you know, today. It's a marvellous book, and yeah, you should definitely be getting a hold of a copy.
Agreed. I think I can echo everything that everyone said there. All that's left for me to do is to once again say thanks to David and Bill for joining us. More importantly, thank you for writing the book. And finally, you know, thank you for listening. Please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.